The Sunday Baroque podcast is made possible by WSHU and the Friends of Sunday Baroque. You can find out more about the Friends of Sunday Baroque and find out how to become one yourself by visiting our website, sundaybaroque.org, under the Contact tab. Soprano Sherazade Pantaki has achieved international success, particularly singing Baroque and early music. She earned an artist diploma with top honors from the Yale School of Music and the Yale Institute of Sacred Music, as well as a master's degree from the University of Illinois and a bachelor's degree from West Virginia Wesleyan College. Sherazade Pantaki has collaborated with many of the world's leading experts, including Nicholas McGuigan and Philharmonia Baroque Orchestra, Masaaki Suzuki and Bach Collegium Japan, and with Tafel Music Baroque Orchestra, and many, many others. Sherazade Pantaki joins me on Zoom to talk about her life as a musician. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Such a great pleasure to be here.
So things are starting to open up, but I'd like to start by asking how you have been managing over this last year with the pandemic.
I appreciate that question. I am very, very fortunate to be one of the few, I think, who have had quite a steady stream of work during the pandemic in various ways. It hasn't been quite the same, of course, as it would be in a normal year. We haven't had the same kinds of concerts, but we've seen a lot of smaller, I think especially the smaller organizations, step up and try to create new kinds of content and new ways of engaging with audiences as well as artists. I mean, you know, it's we all exist in this ecosystem together. And so, you know, I've collaborated a lot with groups across the country doing virtual recordings. One of the most enjoyable has been with Les Delices in Cleveland. The wonderful Deborah Nagy has done such a fantastic job curating a series, an online series, and I've done a lot of collaborations with them as well as some other groups. I have done a few self-accompanied recitals of sort of Dowland and Purcell, Monteverdi, Strozzi, for public radio, for a couple of art series. I've also been guest lecturing quite a bit in Baroque music, in early opera, in Baroque performance practice and style for various schools, universities across the country. And my ensemble that I co-founded with a colleague of mine, the Kaleidoscope Vocal Ensemble, we've been fairly busy doing some guest lectures, putting together an online concert. I've also been teaching at Yale as I do, part-time. I'm music director for Yale's campus, for the university church during the summers, because I have a background in choral music and church music as well. So I'm happy to say that things did come together at the start of the pandemic. I think like everybody else, you know, we all started looking into different careers, you know, and I thought, gee, I mean, should I, you know, start teaching English as a second language? Should, you know, online? Should I, you know, start looking into an arts admin degree? You know, what are some possibilities? Mm-hmm. And I'm really, really happy to say that, you know, things worked out in a way that, you know, I still felt quite fulfilled in just in different ways than usual.
Good, good. Yeah, we've all learned to use technology in different ways, haven't
we? That's right. I mean, what was Zoom, you know, 12 months ago? I mean, I certainly wasn't using it actively then.
Yeah. So I'm so glad that you mentioned self-accompanied, because I understand that you were actually quite an accomplished pianist before you became a singer. And I'd love to untangle that and give us the sort of the arc of how you started learning music and how you got into singing.
Oh, happy to. I was very fortunate that my mother was a really gifted amateur musician. She passed away when I was 8. But in the first few years of my life, I was exposed to a lot of classical music. Both my parents, my mother and my father, really enjoy music. My father has even broader tastes than my mother did. You know, he enjoys listening to old Hindi film songs and Hindi classical music, Indian classical music, but also, you know, has a great love for Western classical music. My mother grew up in a house where there was a piano, and she and her three sisters all took piano lessons as children. You know, and I grew up in India. India being a British colony, you know, there was some of that holdover of, you know, it was pretty common for, especially I think for young women, to take piano lessons. And when I was young, I, you know, had a soundscape of, you know, Bach and Brahms and Handel and, you know, such a rich tapestry of music. I would listen to my mother play. My mother and I would sing together. She was, I think she figured out quite early that I was very musical. And she would, you know, she'd pick a Christmas carol, for instance, and say, okay, now, you know, I want you to make up a harmony to this. You know what harmony is supposed to sound like, you know. So at the age of about 3 or 4, you know, I have these very strong memories of singing with her, and, you know, and learning to figure out sort of what made harmonic sense in music. And she was very keen that I start playing the piano. And, you know, again, with India, you know, having such a holdover from the British system, we had a series of sort of curated levels of exams through the Trinity College of London or the Royal College of Music. And I went through the Trinity system where you have, you know, graded levels of piano and theory and music history. And you sort of, you know, you move through these levels. And I loved playing the piano. You know, it just, I took to it right away. I enjoyed both the aspect of learning to read, but, you know, and figure out how theory worked, but also combining that with playing by ear. Being India, there wasn't a lot of printed, you know, music around. My piano teacher had scores, but, you know, if you heard, you know, a fun little pop song on the radio that you wanted to, you know, recreate on your own, there was no music available for that. And so I just learned to play by ear quite a bit alongside this very structured musical education. And, you know, when my mother passed away, it put a pause in some of that. I associated my music making so much with her presence that I, you know, I sort of refused to play piano for a while. And I'm so grateful to my father for, you know, really, really encouraging me to get back on that horse. We moved to a different city in India, and I had a new piano teacher who was just one of the most extraordinary people I've met and really shaped my musical life. And, you know, she was the kind of person who sort of, you know, she only took students that were very motivated. You know, she really wouldn't put up with any nonsense from anybody. And I think that's what I needed. You know, I needed, you know, a swift kick and in the proverbial pants and, you know, to say, you can do this. You have the capability of this. And, you know, we're going to give you the tools that you need to move forward. And to find that discipline again was a real lifeline for me. I was a much, much better pianist than I am now. You know, once you sort of, once you switch trajectories, it's hard, at least it was for me, to try to do both at the same level. And I started singing more when, we had a, you know, a lovely little choir in my school, which, you know, again, a convent school left over from the British era. And we had, no matter what religion you were, and if, you know, Christianity was very much the minority, but we sang, you know, Catholic hymns every morning because that's what you did. And I started playing for those, you know, for piano for those hymns. We had no hymnal to be seen. But I remembered the older piano teacher playing them. And I said, well, I can do that. I can harmonize that. I've got this. And so I started playing for hymns. And at some point, I think when I was 13 or 14, you know, and your voice starts to come in a little bit more just physically, I was given a solo for the school Christmas concert, and that was O Holy Night. And it was really my first time being put in, you know, in this very unique situation and standing in front of people with the choir. And, you know, the scene was really beautiful. It was in a lovely church and there were candles and, you know, India being India, there's never less than 2,000 people in the audience anywhere. And I got, you know, that was my first chance to be not behind an instrument, but, you know, where my body is my instrument. And using words to communicate, looking at people, you know, really, really experiencing them take it in. And that was an enormous pivotal moment for me. It you know, it made me, I still very much enjoy playing. And, you know, I've played more this year than I have in a while out of necessity. But the act of communicating through text, you know, the act of using, you know, your body and feeling that experience and then watching other people take it in was just fired me, you know, up in a different way. And I started shifting my focus a bit more to vocal music.
Well, I'm so glad too that you point out, you know, your body is your instrument. How do you keep your body healthy when you're a singer? It's so important, you know, the weather, the heat, the your illness, if you're not well or if you have allergies or whatever. How do you keep in good form as a singer?
Yeah, that's I mean, you know, we're all so individual. I think we all have our, you know, our little tricks and little coping mechanisms and our little kind of daily habits that we, you know, hope keep us in good form. Mostly, honestly, for me, it just tends to be fairly common sense. You know, I, on concert days, I don't talk very much. I tend to be very much a hermit, you know, until the moment of the concert. I want to rest my voice so it's completely fresh for the, you know, for the moment of the concert. But I also, there's such an element, you know, performing is simultaneously one of the most exhilarating and yet challenging things that you can do because, you know, live performance, the moment is there and then it's gone. There are no do-overs and everything that you've hoped you've worked for and practiced and tried to be disciplined about, you know, emanates in that moment and then it's gone. And you hope that you can harness all those things together. So for me, it's a lot of, you know, it's getting myself into that frame of mind as well. It's, you know, mind and body. And we all know sometimes, you know, you have to sort of push one against the other a little bit. You've got to, you know, tell your mind to make sure your body does what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I try to not put myself in a situation where I would be talking too loudly. And again, everybody's so individual. I tend to, you know, I think, you know, I enjoy the occasional glass of wine, for instance, as much as anyone else. But I tend to, you know, really stay away from that during performance periods because it's, you know, something I know for myself that, I can feel a little bit of a compromise in the sound. So it's, you know, it's common sense, things like that. Lots of hydration, you know, trying to rest as much as you can, which can be hard when you're in a performance mode and on tour, for instance, you know, and you have late concerts and then early flights the next day. And you just, you know, you have to make sacrifices sometimes about not enjoying some social time that you might because, you know, you need the rest. Right. But otherwise, I'm happy to say for me, it's mostly just been, you know, common sense.
You are really an expert in Baroque and early music. You do it all, but that is really your, you know, that is your sweet spot. And I'm curious to know how you found your way to Baroque and early music repertory and also what you love about it.
Yeah. I did grow up, my first experience with Baroque music probably was playing, you know, Bach inventions on the piano. But before, I should say that was my first experience making music, you know, in an early music field. But my first sound memory is actually the Gloria from the Bach B minor Mass. It's one of the pieces that my parents played quite a lot at home because, as it turns out, they both sang the piece in a choir in Bombay.
Wow.
And so, you know, they knew it really well. And so I listened to it. And, you know, if ever something can get you fired up, I think it's that movement. You know, it's the choir and the orchestra and this sort of dance feeling and the trumpets and the oboes. And it's so joyful. And my ears apparently just latched onto it. Huh. And I asked them to play that piece over and over and over and over again as a child. It's something that just, you know, stayed. And you know, to this day, I think by the time I was 8 years old, I could have sung the soprano line for you of the Gloria of my memory.
Wow.
So that was, you know, this in a sense, I feel like that was part of the building blocks of my musical language, was hearing some of that music. And then I experienced it a little bit as a pianist. But it wasn't until I came to the University of Illinois, where I had a couple of mentors, Charlotte Maddox, who's just an incredible harpsichordist, was and still is the performance practice teacher there, and ran a music collegium, a sort of an early music little series of students and instrument, you know, singers and instrumentalists. And I had a very close friend who picked up on the fact that I had a knack for this music and would take me to see concerts in Chicago, and when Bill Christie came through, or, you know, we made a trip once to New York when Philippe Hervega was coming through with the Matthew Passion. And as I got introduced to this, I found it truly felt to me like I had come home. And if ever I explore the more spiritual side of myself, you know, in a more enhanced way, I might come up with some sort of theory of, you know, that this music, this is an ancient music that sort of has been coded into me somehow, and maybe I lived at the time, and this is another reincarnation. I don't know. But it felt to me like this is a musical language that I instinctively understand. I understand the patterns. I understand the pacing. It makes sense to me, and I found myself wanting to sing this music more and more. And it was really good to find a musical home in that. You know, as an undergrad, I was encouraged to sing, you know, music from all time periods, as one should be. It's you know, it's a bit too early, I think, then to, you know, to really try to specialize. But as much as I, you know, very much enjoy listening to Verdi and Puccini, I didn't quite feel like my voice and my vocal quality was suited for, you know, Verdi operas. Mm-hmm. But when I found early music, the switch sort of, you know, flipped, and it all made sense. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, the, you know, there's the nature and the nurture bit, and while your brain can draw you to something, it takes a lot of study, and it takes practice, and I'm happy to say that, you know, I got quite a bit of that. We also had a lovely Baroque group in town, funnily enough, called Bach, the Baroque Artists of Champagne of Urbana. Oh. And that was a great training experience for me, because I got, you know, I stayed on in Champagne Urbana after my degree and was able to sing the solos in so many Bach and Handel oratorios. It was, you know, it was such a good experience training me for professional life, so that, you know, 7 years later when somebody called and said, we need someone to jump in for, you know, Handel's Israel and Egypt, like, well, I've done that. I can absolutely come in and just do that. Wow. For you, because I had this, you know, wonderful training experience. So it was a nice kind of confluence of circumstances that enhanced my love for early music and my desire to want to be better at it, to learn more about it. And that's what finally gave me the courage then to apply to Yale, to, you know, to a program that specifically does deal in early music, mm-hmm. Which was another life-changing door, but that's a whole other topic.
So would you go over, you know, I think people don't necessarily realize that there are different techniques, there are different issues about singing the, you know, the Verdi operas versus singing Baroque music. So even just things like vibrato and pitch and whatnot, could you talk a little bit about how a singer approaches singing this music that's different from opera?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, some of it will depend on one's own individual vocal color. You know, and that means, you know, does your voice tend to be a little bit more bright, or does it tend to be a little bit, you know, fuller? We all have our own natural sense of vibrato. You know, a good vibrato should come from good, healthy breath technique. And, you know, some people's vibratos are just naturally a little bit quicker, and some people's are naturally a little, some people tend to, you know, veer a little bit more towards a tone that is a bit more straight, and some have a tone that is a bit more full. So there are some sort of intrinsic physical differences that, you know, one does take into account. But there's also quite a big difference in the way the music is structured, and in the pacing and the articulation, especially, of the music. When it comes to early music, and certainly with late Baroque music, with Bach and Handel and Vivaldi, there is a certain sort of a dance element. There's things that you, for instance, might A great example would be, for instance, that in Bach, the highest note of the phrase isn't necessarily the most important note of the phrase. But in Bellini and Puccini and Verdi, it often is. Usually, the way the music is constructed, it's leading you to that sort of climactic moment of the highest note being the most open and the broadest and the fullest, whereas that isn't necessarily the case when it comes to Bach and Handel. And so one learns to, you know, adapt one's technique to make something else more important, to land musically, to bring us to a moment in the music that doesn't have to do with range, but has to do with the text, or has to do with the way the music is structured, or to bring out the rhythmicity of the dance element. When we think of later romantic music, we think of sort of a bel canto style, where the voice, you know, in this instance, becomes truly the most sort of dominant texture of the musical ensemble. And I think most of us, when it comes to early music, really like to think of ourselves, even as soloists, as part of a larger, broader texture. It's not the voice sort of dominating, but you're really interacting with the counterpoint, with this, with, you know, the way the music is structured in very back and forth kind of ways. You know, we each take a turn in being important. We each take a turn in sharing the motive or the melody. It's a different feeling to both vocally, physically, mentally, to interact in that way than, you know, when I sing Brahms Requiem or something like that, where, you know, the voice really does have to be this very, very firm, continuous legato line over the other instruments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I hope that gives us a little bit of context. It's, I mean, good, you know, I do believe that good, healthy singing technique is good technique. And I, you know, most singers, I think, tend to study bel canto technique because it keeps you on your breath and on your voice. And, you know, you don't manipulate yourself vocally into bad habits. And then once you've learned that, you learn to adapt it to some different styles of music.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I was looking at your repertoire list and, you know, obviously there's a lot of Bach and Handel and Vivaldi and Purcell and others like that. But I also noticed that you have quite a lovely representation of Antonia Bembo and Hildegard von Bingen,
yeah,
and Anna Bohn and Barbara Strozzi and Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre. Would you, mm-hmm, talk about these women and their compositions,
yes,
and, you know, what you love about their work and what it means to you to perform it?
Oh, my, absolutely. Barbara Strozzi especially, I think, is just one of my favorites. As a soprano, she is a really, really friendly writer for the soprano voice. She's so dramatic. And Barbara Strozzi, if my research brain serves me correctly, was, I think, the most published composer in Venice of her day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more than anyone else. And, you know, same thing with, you know, Francesca Caccini, for instance, was one of the most celebrated, you know, opera composers of her day.
Mm-hmm.
And we all, I think, understand that it was a different time, and that while women were certainly as equally talented as men, there was an enormous dearth of opportunity and an enormous, you know, pressure put on them, and opportunities not afforded to them to practice their craft. But, you know, thankfully for us, some of these women managed to break through. Mm-hmm. Some of them had the right support and the right backing. Some of them, you know, had parents who encouraged them, or music teachers who encouraged them. And it's such a joy to find a woman's voice being represented in, you know, in quite a sea of men's voices, yeah, at the time.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre, for instance, some of her solo cantatas on such, you know, fascinating subjects like Judith and Esther, you know, these women who are incredibly wronged. And to have a woman write about that, who surely must have felt, you know, much of this persecution and much, you know, so much working against her, mm-hmm, you know, to try to beat the odds, is such an amazing thing to have, you know, Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre's voice represented in this music. And I have I have tried, you know, very hard to uncover more and more music by these women, and it's some of my. I try to program them whenever possible. I love singing this. For a while, I was singing with a group in Boston that specifically focused on women Baroque composers and anonymous composers, a group called La Donna Musicale.
Oh.
And, you know, so that was a chance to do some of Antonia Bembo.
Right.
You know, it's one of the great things about early music is not everything has been recorded. And you so often have a chance to put your own mark and your own stamp on something. And that's true for almost, you know, for almost anything, not to mention I think you have more choices in early music of instrumentation sometimes, even in your continuo groups, it's sort of the underpinning that holds it together. You know, do you want cello and harpsichord? Do you want gamba and theorbo? You know, you can have this variety of texture, but when it comes to the music of some of these women, I mean, some of this really hasn't seen the light of day in 300 years. And so you are literally inventing the wheel and making decisions as you go, and you know, drawing on your experience and what's in the score and what we collectively feel as musicians we can do in the ensemble. So it's really a lot of fun to uncover some of those works,
mm-hmm.
and and put you know, find your voice through them.
So you've kind of come back home now. You're teaching at Yale. You mentioned that before. And
that's right.
This is all the things we've already talked about, and the things that you do in your career are ways for you to sort of bring that home for your own students now, to usher them into this world of professional music making. What do you love about teaching? What are some of the highlights for you?
Oh, I mean, I absolutely love teaching. And here at Yale, the students that I teach are the graduate choral conductors.
Oh.
And, you know, so these are students who are going to be working with voices and, you know, hopefully are, you know, future conductors, future leaders of ensembles. And as somebody who really enjoys the sort of the minutiae of vocal technique, you know, who's had to work through, as, you know, most singers, we've had to sort of work through our vocal technique ourselves. And, So as somebody who enjoys that, it's important for me that my students understand what the foundations of good vocal technique are. It's also important for me that they empathize with the feeling of, you know, of being a singer, in terms of, you know, they'll be conductors, they'll be hiring soloists. And it's important that they know what it means for somebody to stand up there and use your body to sing and, you know, prepare music and sometimes memorize music. We also explore a lot of repertoire from pieces that they might eventually conduct themselves someday. You know, I have students that, for instance, say, well, you know, one of my, you know, bucket list pieces is to do the St. Matthew Passion. Can I work on the evangelist role with you? Somebody might say, you know, I just want a real overview of some of the oratorios. You know, I might conduct Mendelssohn's Elijah someday, or Brahms' Requiem. Can we work on those pieces? And so in this particular instance, it's really a lot of fun for me, because we get to work on technique. We get to, hone their understanding of how voices work, how they should talk to their own choir members and ensemble members, and then explore a lot of repertoire. And so, you know, I'm not necessarily preparing them for professional solo life, but I do have private students that I am doing that for. And that's, you know, they're at various levels. I have students going off to graduate school, now, and you know, getting them ready for auditions and roles. It's being a teacher, you know, means having 100% of your focus on somebody for 60 minutes at a time. I mean, you're taking in absolutely everything that they are doing with their bodies, with their breath, with their posture, with their phrasing. You know, how can your technique serve your musicianship? It's something, it took me a while to figure out. You know, I'd listen to recordings and of myself, you know, early on, and say, oh gosh, well, that didn't sound like what I thought it was sounding like in the moment. Here's what I thought I was doing, but you know, I didn't have the understanding yet to make my technique serve the expression that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this great, you know, brain puzzle challenge every lesson of, you know, with everybody's individual body and individual voice. And, right. you know, we look at the space in your throat and the space in your head and the angle of your cheek and this lift of the soft palate and the posture and the support. And no lesson is ever the same as anyone else's. And it's really fun for me to kind of put these pieces of a puzzle together.
Yeah. And I would think, you know, for someone who is as naturally talented as you are, you know, you from the time you were just a little girl, having this aptitude, is that harder? You know, if it comes naturally to you, is it harder to try to explain it to someone else?
Well, you know, in my case, yes, there was that. I was singing quite early, but it took a lot of work on my own part as well for me to figure out the full capabilities of what my specific instrument was able to do. You know, have had wonderful teachers over the years, and in the past, almost, 10 years, I've worked with somebody in New York who has really sort of opened my mind up to sort of understanding what my body can physically do to create the sound that I want. So it's been a real learning experience for me, which is one of the things that has made me very passionate as a teacher about communicating, you know, this technique. I want people to not sound like anyone else that they've heard, but to feel like they are using their body's full potential in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to experience that yourself. No two people are alike.
Yeah, yeah. So what are you passionate about? What are you excited about at this moment? Is there some special project you're looking forward to, or some repertory that you're hoping to tackle or planning to tackle?
Oh, gosh, there are so many. I'm about to record some soprano bass cantatas in San Francisco next week in the Bay Area, with a group from within Philharmonia Baroque called the Cantata Collective, that's really are focused on doing Bach concerts and recordings. And the following week, I will be in Vienna, Austria, to work on Handel's Alexander's Feast with the Vienna Academy in this beautiful hall. It'll be my first time with choir and orchestra and audience in the same space. And I'm so looking forward to that. You know, Handel oratorios are very much part of my bread and butter. And this piece has some glorious music for soprano. You know, so I am really excited that concerts seem to be coming back. I hope that, you know, people have a feverish anticipation for live performance and wanting to go to concerts and, you know, feed their souls in that way. But in the last couple of years, I also have co-founded an ensemble with a colleague of mine, Ariana Bella, and the ensemble is the Kaleidoscope Vocal Ensemble that focuses on diversity and excellence in early music and in new music. And this came out of, you know, many years of conversations with my colleague about often finding ourselves as the only people of color in early music, in classical music. And yet, you know, we had some incredibly talented friends, and we thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could have a group of us together where, you know, 8, 9, 10 of us walk out onto a stage and here is this, you know, just kaleidoscope, if you will, of, you know, of different races and cultures and people, you know, what a strong visual representation that would be for our audiences, but also for students. And, you know, and so we have started working a lot with student groups. There's a choir in New Haven, the Morse Chorale, that we have a wonderful tie with, just an incredibly talented group of sort of school age kids of such varying ethnicities and cultures, so much beautiful diversity. And I mean, I've just never met a group of kids more passionate about choir and about music and about singing together. We really want to sort of show that diversity and excellence go hand in hand, and that one isn't defined by, you know, somebody else's cultural expectations of you. You know, I'm from India and I was born and raised there. I mean, you can't, you know, I didn't leave there till I was 17 or 18. And why does that mean that I shouldn't, you know, explore early music? Why does that mean I shouldn't devote my life to the study of Bach?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there is, you know, like it or not, there is some ingrained, you know, cultural expectation of people from, you know, of people that are minorities.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to work, you know, want to do my part in trying to dispel that, mm-hmm. making sure, you know, we all have access, we all have equity, we all have role models. You know, there was certainly nobody I knew when I first came over to the States. There was no Indian classical singer, Western, you know, in Western classical music that I had met and that I could go to and say, well, you know, what could some of my next steps be? How do I make this work? How does one forge a path? And of course, it's different for everybody. But, you know, we certainly know that being from a minority, you know, it imposes its own set of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are always extra hurdles. There's always something more that you have to do. And it would have been wonderful to have somebody lead me through. That isn't to say that, you know, I am so grateful to those who have mentored me along the way, you know, and no one is an island, and I certainly couldn't have done any of this myself. I have been very nurtured by some key people in my life, and I'm truly grateful for that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, I think with this ensemble, we are broadening that as much as possible, and we want to show just how much wealth there is in different races and cultural backgrounds in this country.
Yeah.
You know, we want it to be America. This is what America looks like. And sometimes classical music isn't what America really looks like.
Yes.
But, you know, we want to show that.
Yeah. So does Kaleidoscope have any recordings yet?
We are making some professional recordings next year, hopefully. I mean, we started just a few months before the pandemic. And so, of course, that shut everything down for us. We do have a lot of virtual content that, you know, the virtual sort of videos that we've put together with everybody recording from their homes, as you know, as we've all done this year. And we have, as a group, done a lot of, you know, guest lecturing and, you know, meetings with various colleges and universities and art schools across the country. And that's been fun to have these conversations where we talk about some fairly tough issues and, mm-hmm. you know, what it's like to be people of color, what it's, you know, in classical music and mm-hmm. what that means for all of us. But we hope that, you know, we also had several invitations for festivals and concerts that we had to turn down naturally, mm-hmm. You know, or they were canceled. But that we hope that's coming back next year. We've had a lot of interest for next year already. And so we'll be making some recordings coming soon.
Excellent. I look forward to sharing those
with
listeners.
You.
That's wonderful. I have been speaking with acclaimed soprano Shahrezad Pantaki about her international career as a singer, teacher, and expert in the field of Baroque and early music. Thank you very much for chatting.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I am a huge fan of Sunday Baroque.
Oh, thanks.
It's been one of my, you know, weekly pleasures. So thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, thank you.